2000 AD, 40 years of Thrill Power Festival, the originals. Borak Thung, Earthlitz, and welcome to a supplemental episode of the 2000 AD Thrillcast. At the beginning of February, we had a fantastically successful 40th anniversary event, and it was an incredible day. Over 1,000 Squatstick Thargo, over 100 creators, all crammed into the Novotel in Hammersmith in London for a day of panels and signings and sketchings and just general fun. And all the feedback we've had has been absolutely wonderful. So thank you to everybody who came. Now, we appreciate that not everybody could get tickets, so we thought we would bring the event to you. So in between episodes of the 2000 AD Thrillcast, we're going to be bringing you panels recorded at the 40 years of Thrill Power Festival. And this week, it's the originals with the absolutely incredible lineup of Dave Gibbons, Mick McMahon, and Cam Kennedy. Four of the biggest names to ever grace the pages at 2000 AD came together for one unmissable panel. From Mick's early work on Judge Dredd and Slain to Alan's incredible writing on Anderson's Cider Vision and Judge Dredd, Dave's groundbreaking work on Dan Dare and Rogue Trooper, and Cam Kennedy, who has been always an inspiration on strips like Judge Dredd. This quartet helped define 2080's earliest days and set it on its path to greatness. So enjoy listening to them discuss their groundbreaking work and the industry-shaping careers that it helped launch. Your host for the originals is Ollie McNamee.
Now, I've got a number of questions, but with such a big audience, it's as much your con as everyone else's. So I'm going to keep it very brief, and I'm just going to go straight in at the deep end and ask, what was it like in those heady times of the late 70s, those depressing 70s, coming to work in London, coming to live in London? Maybe Dave and Mick, because I know you shared a studio in St Albans. What was it like being at the epicentre of the punk rock movement and basically a cultural movement in Britain at the time?
That's great.
Next question.
I don't remember any of it.
Which is why it was such a great time.
Well, I wasn't living in this country at the time, so I didn't come back to this country till 78, and these guys had already started.
Well, I didn't really realise anything was going on at all, to be honest.
Well, no, I mean, you know, you've given a very florid description of it, but really it just felt like business as usual in many ways, I think. I think what 2000 AD did do was capture a lot of people who had grown up reading American comics, certainly like me, like Brian Bolan, Kevin O'Neill, Mick to a degree, although his passion was English war comics. And we were all ready, we'd all been working long enough to know what we were doing, but we still had that sort of passion of being comics fans, and 2000 AD was the perfect kind of clubhouse. So there was a wonderful kind of esprit de corps, friendly rivalry, and and it gave all of us a tremendous kickstart to our careers, I think.
Was it then sort of, you know, you all played together, you all worked together, and you all went to the pub on a Friday afternoon? What was a normal day, if we can call that? What was a normal day, abnormal day at 2000 AD like?
Well, I mean, we just went in there once every couple of weeks to deliver some artwork, frankly. I mean, it was it's exactly the same as now. You're just sitting at home drawing. Yeah, and you might arrange sometimes once every couple of months that we'd all deliver something on the same day and go to the pub and gossip and stuff, but that was it really, because it's like a cottage industry, and it's like just you get together just to talk to someone about your problems, really, you know, like what sort of pen you're using and stuff like that, you know. It's like we weren't discussing revolution, you know. It's like
no, that's quite true. But I didn't live in London, so I was one of the branches of the cottage industry, so I was up in Scotland. And as Mick says, you just came down from time to time, see the editor, and then wait for your cheque to come. That was it. It was a very solitary occupation. I know these two guys work together, but no, it's just good fun if you like to be alone.
Well, what about the influences then? I mean, obviously, each of you had different influences. I mean, 2000 AD is a wonderful example of what we in Britain do, a satirical comic that holds a crack mirror up against society. And it did so then, as it does so now. What were some of those influences early back then that worked on all of your different heroes, like Harlem Heroes, for example, like Judge Anderson? Because there's some debate whether or not Brian Boland did base on Debbie Harry or not. What was in your mind, Alan? What was in your mind, Dave, around some of yours? And certainly, Cam, for me, my generation, I got into 2000 AD in the 80s, so for you, you know, for me there was Chopper, there was Judge Dredd, there was your work on Road Trip as well, that was the era for me, and of course Slain with you, Mick, as well, that was my era. So what were some of those influences in the 70s and sport in the 80s as well?
I think what happened was, like Dave said about his influence from American comics and mine from British comics, and other people had other influences, but when they came together in our own work, our influences were sort of in our own work, but then our individual work influenced each other a lot, I think, because I know I sort of was very impressed with Kevin O'Neill's work and Dave's, you know, and Cam's, but...
He finally admits it.
It's almost like you were, it's sort of like osmosis or something, where you take little bits, not probably consciously, but the sort of sensibilities would sort of generally pervade each other's work, I think. And that's why it became so sort of visually striking, really, because people were sort of taking an approach they probably wouldn't have done otherwise. I mean, I know that all I ever really wanted to do was draw like Gino D'Antonio, but As I did more and more professional work, I became much more influenced by sort of contemporary stuff that probably wouldn't have happened if it hadn't been for like working on 2000 AD. Because it's actually meeting the people that does that. It's not just looking at their work. So you can look at the work and see know the person as well, and it does make a big difference.
And did it work well with you and Dave sharing a studio? Was there like a friendly rivalry? Did you learn from one another? Did you keep yourself encouraged and keep on going through the late nights?
Well, I don't know that we ever did late nights, actually. You know, I've always been a pretty kind of normal office hours artist. So we used to get in there about 9 o'clock in the morning and leave about 6 o'clock in the evening. All I can remember of it, really, is... listen to Derek and Clive or the Test cricket when it was on, because Mick had to have his Test cricket on. And I've never been interested in sports, but I actually got quite into that because it's got a certain zen-like quality, particularly when rain stops play and you get two blokes talking for 3 hours about a cake, you know. So that's something I remember. But miraculously, and a lot of pissing about and a lot of arguing as to what music we were going to have on or who was going to make the coffee and, you know, sometimes willfully distracting each other. Or Mick used to come around and stand behind me and watch me draw and belch and then go and sit down again, which, of course, you could never work it out. But I think the fact that we did get on really well together, as you can probably tell, I'm somebody who talks and talks and talks and talks. Mick's a much better listener than me, so that worked out quite well. I think our personalities meshed. But... the thing that was amazing, because those are my memories, not really of working, of just having a laugh, that actually while we were in that studio, and to call it a studio is actually, you know, rather elevating it. It was in fact a sort of a potting shed behind an antique shop, and the roof was so leaky we would never leave any artwork out. It always had to go in plastic in drawers. But actually in that humble shed, Road Trooper was born. I remember working on that there. I drew loads of Doctor Who. Mick did fantastic Block Wars artwork, and I think you did some Doctor Who, and it was really inspiring. I never worked in the same room as anybody before, but there is something quite stimulating about it, and something that again makes you improve your game. And Mick is such a fantastically painstaking artist. I was in awe of the meticulous way that he would draw. And I suppose, if anything, he was in awe of the speed with which I drew, you know. So it was good. It was a really happy meshing of the minds. And we're still friends to this day.
Thank you for that. Well, one question more from me then, because there seems to be a debate at the moment whether there is any room for politics in arts and in comics. And I was wondering what you, Alan, thought, and broaden it over to all the creators on stage. Because for me, it seems like 2000 AD is the gateway into private eye and into satire. And I think for many young people who we all were once upon a time, that was our first taste of good British satire, and certainly our first taste of maybe even politics. Is there a place for politics in comics today?
Yeah, of course there is. I'm one of these people who's always hated authority. Prior to 2000 AD, I'd worked as a romantic fiction writer, which was killing me quite quickly. So when they offered me a job on 2000 AD, it was like stepping into a different world. And they passed by the Friday afternoon thing when they mentioned it. But for me, that was a great... because I was working editorially to start with on 2000 AD. And every Friday at lunchtime, work stopped because artists came to the office, hung around for an hour or an hour and a half, and then we all went to the Dog and Ducket, the pub, and we were there till tea time. And in fact, sometimes we were there at 11 o'clock at night. And it was like stepping into a different world. I loved it. But your question was actually about satire and politics in comics. Unless a comic I'm working on is satirical, I really have very little interest in working on it. As you can, if you look through the things that I've done over the years, the ones that didn't have any satirical or political comment are the stories that bored me to tears, and I'm sure they bored the readers to tears as well.
Well, thank you for that. I'm going to open it up to the floor because obviously it's a huge gathering. I'm sure there's lots of questions you could ask any one of these four. Anyone got a question? At the back there, you were first up there and then you, sir, second.
Hi, gents. My question is this. We see the finished results of your work, brilliant as it is, but what about the days when inspiration doesn't strike and maybe cabin fever sets in? What do you do then to try and inspire yourselves?
Well, I mean, 2000 AD was done on a weekly schedule, so the pages had to be in. So all you could possibly do was do the best you could in that time. And some days you're inspired and other days you're not. But they, I mean, really the hallmark of a professional creator is you create whether you feel like it or not. I found it a lot more difficult since I've got more leeway and not such tight deadlines to actually produce anything at all. So really the deadline pressure is your friend when it comes to being creative. And of course there's also the thing that the inspiration never strikes if you're not sat in front of the keyboard or in front of the drawing board. So at least sit yourself down and try and do something is my approach.
I used to take the day off if I wasn't inspired.
Yeah.
Dave's right about the deadline pressures. There's nothing like a deadline for making you work, for inspiring you. Yeah. But when I was working editorially, there was no pressure on like that. It wasn't until I started working with John Wagner that pressure was, in fact, on. But if I wasn't inspired, I just took the day off. I wasn't going to waste 8 hours sitting in front of a typewriter worrying about it. It's much easier to go away and smoke dope or drink drink whiskey or whatever.
Or both.
Or both, yeah.
Yeah, I just, because where I live, I just would go fishing or walking on the cliffs or having a drink with friends. But the deadline thing always worked for me. Because, you know, in a day, maybe the guys will tell you, might do one frame, but then the next day I might do 21 frames because you get a roll on. I mean, I don't work from 9 till 6. I work at some time during the week to meet the final date. So I could be very, very productive all of a sudden. 15, 16 hours, but then the next day do 1 hour. I couldn't do 9 to 6, 9 to 5, but I know a lot of people do work that way, Dave, for example. So that's what I did.
I used to actually, and I used to do it partly to intimidate Mick. I used to have my three-month plan taped to the wall with what I had to do on which day. And then the best thing was at the end of the 3 months when I ticked the last one off to say, well, that's another successful quarter and stick it in the bin. Mick, on the other hand, Mick could tell this story himself. But what really amused me about Mick was he would be very meticulous and he'd do beautiful, beautiful drawings. And as he once said to me, don't forget, Dave, whatever you draw is going to be there forever. So if he had 3 weeks to do a dread, in the first 2.5 weeks, he'd maybe do about 8 panels over 6 pages, the ones he fancied. And then it would be the day before deadline. Oh, shit. And he'd draw the whole of the rest of it. And there wasn't really any difference in quality. And every interview I've ever seen with Mick is illustrated by the ones that he knocked off in 20 minutes.
Yeah, so. And you'll probably find, Mick, they produced the real quality stuff when it's rushed. Isn't it?
Well, I think I enjoy the process too much, really.
I enjoy the pencils. Yeah, I love my pencils. And I find it's just becomes functional to ink them.
Yeah, I mean, it's like listening. I can listen to music. I actually listen to music while I'm penciling, but I could listen to an audio book while I'm inking. You know, it's like, it's different sort of your brain,
Because penciling for us is so spontaneous, and I always found that the first drawings you put down were the best. I very rarely changed anything. And then, as we said, that the functional bit comes in of putting ink on it. And then when, I don't know if you've done jobs where you coloured as well, Mick, on your inks. But that's, you know, it's, you get a nice result, but it's you're doing the same job 3 times. Unless you get somebody to colour it, but no. That's it.
Okay, so different answers there. One could be sit in front of the computer, hope it comes, or have the day off and smoke dope, whatever that is, I'm not sure. Okay, next question, please.
One or 2000 AD. I never would have believed that I would be sat here 40 years later actually seeing it still going. What do you guys put down the longevity of 2002, and why do you think it's never been repeated in this country?
Well, I think
there's probably two
prime words, and that's Pat Mills. I think, you know, it's arguable that the enthusiasm and the vision that Pat originally brought to it was a tremendous jolt. And I don't know why it's been so successful in the long term, 2000 AD. It is beyond any doubt the most popular, the most successful British comic ever. And I think part of it is that the readers have grown up with it. I mean, it's interesting to look around here. The demographic is actually about... Given that we were working on this in our 20s and 30s, and you must have been reading it in maybe, you know, when you were 10, 15 or so. Mm-hmm. And we've all kind of grown up with it, I think, and it's sort of kept its readership. And it's interesting, in the news agents, it is racked with private eye in magazines like that, usually, rather than with comics.
Do you know what, W.H. Smith, I have to ask for it because it gets robbed. It's the most robbed thing they have in my local. I might have to tell Rebellion. If they've got less circulation next week, they'll know why. But yeah, it seems to be quite common there. Right. So it does track it. But yeah, it's very strange. You have to actually ask for it.
Mm.
I mean, it's part then. I mean, good science fiction is meant to reflect the fears of society. And of course, we know we've touched on the satire elements. Has that got something to do with you think that no matter how old Judge Dredd gets, he's still fresh, he's still relevant, the stories he's telling in a futuristic utopia dystopia still have something to say about the world today?
I don't think he would have been nearly as successful as he has been if it wasn't for that fact. Any story that you come up with is much better if it's based on something that's current in the newspaper. When John Wagner and I were writing Judge Dredd together, we used to buy the Sun, the Star, and I think there was another tabloid at the time, I can't remember what it was, and look through the tabloids for stories that we could extrapolate into Dredd's future. I don't know if they still do that, but that was certainly how we did it.
The Sun is a comic nowadays, isn't it?
And of course, these things do come around again. I mean, on the internet, loads of people are showing excerpts from Judge Caligula with eerily present-day sentiments and wondering why there aren't any crowds in the streets to cheer him. You know, it was done 30 years ago, but it's got an eternal message, I think.
Thank you for that. If there's nothing more to add to that, are there any more questions from the floor? There's one at the front here.
This question is for Alan and for Cam as well. In a lot of your comics, whether it's for 2000 AD or Batman or The Punisher, there's a very strong Scottish inclination. They always go to Scotland at some point, or there's a lot of action that's set in Scotland. Is that something you consciously try to inject into your work, or does it just end up going in that direction?
No, it's something that I consciously inject into. I wanted Batman to have Scottish ancestry. I wanted the Punisher to come to Scotland. Although, funnily enough, when John Wagner and I submitted the first Punisher script to Marvel, they sent it back and told us to take out all of the Scottish humour. Not that we'd made the Punisher humorous, but the bit characters round about. It's much more interesting to write a story with humorous characters than it is to write one with just straight characters.
Sorry. Yeah, when we were doing Punisher, I did, I can't remember, let's say the first 16 pages, finished pencils. And at that time, you just send them over to Marvel. And I got a phone call, and he said, nice stuff, Cam, he said, but he said, Frank isn't packing. So I said, do you mean like guns? And he said, yeah, you know, Frank's got to be tooled up, you know. I said, this is Edinburgh. If Frank Castle walked down the Royal Mail in Edinburgh armed to the teeth, the Scottish constabulary would very quickly lift him. And he said to me, wow, you guys don't have guns, huh? I said, no, don't. So I got away with it. But he did have guns later on in the story. Well, he had to, didn't he? Because fighting bad guys.
Another question over here.
This question's for Mick. Famously, Mick, and I've followed your career for 40 years, you've changed your style. Can you go back at some point and think in the same mindset as a younger artist and produce and reproduce work, or is it gone? I mean, that's something that you can't go back to. You develop, and it's your style has changed considerably over the years.
No, you can never go back, I don't think, because it's so many things go on to make you do sort of stuff the way you do it. Like I was talking about earlier, about influences from other people. Then when you start working on your own all the time, you sort of go off in all sorts of tangents, I find. Because I haven't read a comic, really, for about 30 years now. Mm-hmm. So it's just me teaching myself as usual, you know, because I did about 5 years where I worked in video games. And it's strange that although I work on my own, I am institutionalized because I cannot ask other people how to do something. I have to teach myself, which is the whole sort of thrust of what I do, really. I mean, I'll be sitting in a room full of 60 people who know exactly how to do what I'm trying to do, but it wouldn't even occur to me to go and ask them. I have to spend, you know, like 3 hours sort of working out how to build some polygon thing or something. It's ridiculous, but that's the way it is. You know, I'm just sort of stuck with it, really.
Yeah, it's a continual evolution. I mean, you can go back and look at stuff you've done a long time ago, but it's like music as well. You know, sometimes the public want you to stay the way you were 30 years ago for music or for art, but you do evolve, and happily a lot of people come along with it and understand it and wish that they could do the same.
Yeah, I was going to say that, I mean, when I look at work I've done even 10 years ago, it's like it's done by somebody else. Like, I can't imagine how I did it. I'm completely baffled, to be honest. I thought, well, and then I look at it, I think, oh, I did used to know how to draw that. And because I'm still sort of, I don't know, it's hard to explain it, really. It's,
do you get asked to sign things you don't remember doing?
Yeah.
That was the 70s. No, that happens a lot, actually, yeah.
It is a strange thing, actually, with your own artwork. I mean, when you start off drawing something, it's going to be the best thing that you ever did, and that's a fact. Otherwise, you couldn't do it. So you start to do it, and it turns out to be work, and you work your way through it, and you finish it, and you don't really like it, but you've got to hand it in, and then you see it in print, and it's as bad as you thought it was, and you're so embarrassed about it, and you shove it in a cupboard. And then 5-10 years later, you're looking for something else, and you come across it, and you look at it, and you think, that's all right. That's that, you know.
I wonder who sent you that.
And the reason for it is, in case any of the other artists or aspiring artists in the room find it dispiriting, after many years, I figured it out. It's because you're the only person in the world who ever saw what it could have been. All anybody else sees is what it was. And after 5-10 years, you see what it was. So it relates more to the earlier question. It's the inside and outside process of drawing. But like Mick, I feel I am continually learning, and I love to learn. And I think unless you are learning, you're kind of dead. You know, if you don't change, you die. That's the way I think. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Three questions before we're going to say 1, 2, 3, and I can sit back for a bit longer now.
Just picking up on what Dave said, of the stories and artworks that you've created then, which would you say have come closest to your platonic ideal of that you imagined?
The one I'm going to do next week. Well, no, I mean, I had a chance to draw some good stuff on 2000 AD. I loved the Charlie and the Terramex thing, which arguably was drawing a lot of robots, which is slightly easier to draw than real breathing people. But I look back upon that fondly, and also some of the future shocks and time twisters that I did, particularly with Alan Moore, which was how we sort of got to know each other. And looking back, I'm very happy with those. And in fact, they recently reprinted all the Dan Dare stuff. At the time, I sort of felt I hacked out a bit. But I thought, well, yeah, there's loads wrong with that. I do it completely differently now. But it's got a sort of a muscular momentum to it, which is exciting, even if it isn't particularly well drawn.
Oh, it's one of us.
I was going to say, I mean, the only time anything came out almost exactly as I'd seen it in my mind was when I was working for Sonic the Comic, and I drew a strip called Decap Attack, which is based on a video game. And that did actually look exactly the way, and it felt really weird, actually. I thought, well, the what's gone wrong here? Because I'm not used to this, and I got a bit frightened. You know, so. But that did come out exactly what I as I'd seen it.
I enjoyed the freedom that Dredd as a character gave me, because once you get over the initial period of thinking, how can I leave my mark on this? It's so much fun to draw, and you can really exaggerate them, which you can't do with more regimented characters. You get... Well, Mick will tell you this as well. I mean, you can exaggerate so much in Dredd, and you can become quite dumpy, and next minute he's really extra thin. It's a great freedom to have with a character. Rogue Trooper was a good character to draw, but he was a bit more what you'd say regimented. Couldn't really do a lot with him. Sometimes you had to be quite serious. Dredd gave me a lot of chances to do humour. With Kenny Who and what have you.
In a similar vein.
An old man moment.
A senior moment.
Alan's having a senior moment.
I think some members of the audience are as well, so...
Give him a nod, you can answer this one as well. In a similar way, I did want to know what each of you's favourite work from 2000 AD that you've done, and also if there was anything that you wish you'd been asked to do but weren't.
I think I already answered that in my last question.
Yeah.
No, I
don't think I've never been asked. No, forget that. The favourite thing I've ever done for 2000 AD was a Judge Anderson story, Shambhala. I read it again quite recently and I thoroughly enjoyed it. Had nothing to do with judging, but I mean, I really enjoyed it. I was interested in Fortiana at the time. I was a reader of the Fortean Times, and it was all based on that. I don't think any of it was true, but it made a good story.
I think probably my favourite strip I worked on was Slain. There's a few dreads I really enjoyed. Well, I enjoyed all of them, really. But, I mean, they were only one-off stories, but they were ones where I thought I'd made some sort of breakthrough or something. I don't know. So it was different than the one I'd drawn before. And I thought that, you know, I'm man moving forward. So I think there's one about people who jump off sort of tower blocks and sort of fly or something. I don't know.
The leapers, yeah.
Or whatever it was, yeah. But, there are sort of, it's very vague in my head. They're little sort of bulbs of progress, I suppose. That's about what it is.
And it won't get any better.
they're certainly going dim.
It was dread for me, but there was nothing else I really wanted to draw. Because I used to do painting as well. I lived in France, I was a painter. But see, I wasn't a really big comic buff. When I first got into comics, I found you could make money for doing something that you really enjoy doing. And it was a friend of mine said, you should send some samples to, I think a way back it was DC Thompson, first of all. And then when I came back from France, I sent samples to, was it Fleetway? It was Fleetway. And that IPC, when McManus was in. So I got work straight away and I thought, this is pretty easy. As I say, I wasn't a big comic buff, and I was very mercenary about comics. I did use them to make money, which permitted me to do other things, such as, you know, told you before, fishing and being with friends and wandering around.
Well, here's a question before we take on the next question. I think was over here. Alan, you picked up on, obviously as a writer, a creator, you can put a lot of yourself in it. I know that sort of when you create Anarchy, you were into that kind of movement. I mean, what about us from an artist's point of view? And I know a number of you have done some writing as well as artwork. How much of yourself can you put into Rogue Trooper? How much of yourself can you put into Chopper? How much of yourself can you put into Slain, for example? Is that availability to do that?
I think you just put your talent into it. I've never felt as though Joe and I should go out together on anything. It's just a character to draw as far as I'm concerned.
But surely you must have some say on the initial look of it and how he or she ends up on the page.
It just comes.
I find it's like a sort of feedback thing where I read the script and the character starts to come to life. And when I'm drawing the character, I feel the emotion that the character's feeling. And that's how I know how to draw it. And it's not a conscious thing. It's just how it happens. I mean, to be honest, these kind of ideas about, you know, like putting yourself into the thing, I mean, that's why I gave up being a fine artist, because to me, it's visual, and it's not, you can't sort of express it in that way, really. It's because I think when I was at art school, the real thing they wanted to do was write a manifesto rather than make a painting, you know. So, and I couldn't get on with that. So, but I think that's the only way I feel I put myself into something. I mean, I don't have an idea that I want to shoehorn in. It's just my emotions go into it, really, and that's about it. So.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the difference, is that if you're doing, say, fine art, you're pleasing yourself. But the whole thing about what we do is it's entertainment for other people. So what I've always tried to do is to make what I do as entertaining and as engaging as possible. And part of that is having a clear enough picture of it in your own head to be able to transmit that. You know, you have to see it really quite clearly and then get down that vision. But that's what you're trying to do, is to make the story as exciting as possible, to make it as coherent as possible. And I've only ever really wanted to draw well enough, and one day I might achieve this, I only wanted to ever draw well enough that the reader doesn't fall out of the story. I don't want to draw in a way that people say, what wonderful art. Oh, isn't he such a good artist? In a way, once they start noticing that, it's a bit like the movie director, Sam Goldwyn, when he got a particularly florid script, would say, I smell a writer. You know, you have to try and do it to the point that, and sure, there can be very stylized worlds, worlds with different flavors. And obviously, the way Mick draws is completely different than the way I draw. But if it's consistent within itself, then you create a world for the reader to inhabit. And it is really the reader that you should have in mind rather than yourself.
Thank you. Next question from the floor, please.
Hello, guys. First off, I have to say thank you for the amazing and inspirational work over the years. And I think I speak for a lot of people here when I say my life wouldn't be the same if it hadn't been for 2000 AD. Anyway, gushing over, onto the question. If you could, I know there was obviously a lot of issues in the early days about money for reprints and what have you, so I don't want to go there maybe, but if you could sort of send a little time message back 40 years to yourselves, what sort of creative advice would you perhaps give to your younger selves that you've now learnt?
Smoke more dope.
Smoke better dope. I wouldn't have any message to send back to myself, because I know that my prior self would just ignore it anyway.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, because I mean, I will, you know, I know best. So,
I'd become a plumber. Make really good money.
Well, I suppose I'd say to myself, Dave, don't worry about the fact you've got to have the artwork done by Tuesday. You will do it, and in 40 years' time, you will be sat there talking about it. So, don't worry.
Are there any other questions from the floor? Yes, there's one at the back and there's one there. We're going to try and get a third one in because we've got just about 7 or 8 minutes left. So three from the back then, please.
Hi, I just wondered if you had any horror stories about missed deadlines, artwork going missing, coffee spills or anything like that that you remember.
Fridays in the pub.
Well, I remember a set of Dread artwork. I think it was by Steve Dillon, which Tom Frame left in a taxi someplace. But Tom was so drunk when he left it, he couldn't remember where he'd caught the taxi or where it was going or anything else. But, no.
No, that was me. Yeah, because I'd redrew it over the weekend.
And it was great because I lettered it, I think, yeah. And it was drawn at actual size, but it was you did it so quickly, you could have been doing that all the time.
When I finished it, I thought, oh, I'm going to be so rich. I tell you.
No, I don't remember anything that untoward. No. I just remember I used to get phoned by editors, and because I worked quick, fast, they would say, somebody's let me down, can you do this such and such a sketch for, I need to have it by Monday, my job's on the line, etc. So I'd work all night and put it on an early morning train from Scotland. Then you find out the bastard was off playing golf. I don't play golf.
Enough time for the two more questions then, I believe.
Hello, for me, 2000 AD was famous for its brilliant, sharp, and on occasions, nasty sense of humour. Where do you think that sense of humour come from? And did you ever think it went a bit too far? But I loved it.
I don't know where it came from, but I never think it went too far. Although, no, it never went too far. It never went too far.
What about other people's opinions on the sort of the kind of humour that and the boundaries 2000 AD was pushing on a weekly basis?
Well, I mean, it was a very British sense of humour, or Scottish sense of humour, you know, which was great. And there was a slight kind of disregard for American comics. You know, I think not everybody on the comic was a big fan of American comics. So there was almost, I used to think, a way of not making it like an American comic, you know, to make it very strongly British. But no, I don't think it ever went too far. No.
Sorry, we used to have a good laugh with John and Alan when we were put stories of a Scottish theme to American editors who, I mean, Americans, I know there's Americans here, I'm sorry, but very insular, huge country, but they're very insular. And they obviously, editors in America don't do much in the way of homework about, you know, when they get scripts in, because where I live, there's a stack, a rock stack sticking out of the sea. And I don't know, it's about 400 and something feet high. And it's kind of narrow. So Alan and John had Nick Fury in Orkney climbing up this stack, and his little feedback in his panel was, got some news of maybe a terrorist base on top of the Old Man Ahoy. And because John and Alan had been to, you know, they'd stayed with me and they knew what it was. But the editor had no idea. The top of the Old Man Ahoy is the size of a dining room table. and there was various other ones that were like that. Where, you know, it might seem a wee bit cruel, you know, because, but no, they should do their homework. They should read, listen to. Denny O'Neill was a great one for knowing nothing. Denny and the Bread Fairy. Remember him, Alan? Remember his wife, the Bread Fairy?
Now this is the stuff you came for, isn't it?
And on that bombshell, I'm afraid, gentlemen, unfortunately, we are running out of time. I did want to keep this very much looking at the, you know, the originals and very much looking at those first 10, 15 years. I think we've managed to do that. We could have gone off on all different tangents. I'd like to thank all the guests. I'd like to thank all of you, wherever you've come from, whether it's America or further afield. You're all welcome in this country. And
sure are.
Go out, say hello. They're all very approachable. And happy birthday, 2000 AD. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, we hope you enjoyed that, Earthlitz. Sorry about any sound issues. This was, of course, being recorded in front of a live audience. So not everybody's microphone technique is perfect, but I hope you at least got the gist of this panel. An absolutely fascinating insight into the behind-the-scenes work that goes on in creating the galaxy's greatest comic. Join us next week for a regular episode of the 2000 AD Thrillcast, and make sure you tune in 2 weeks' time for another amazing panel from the 40 years of Thrill Power Festival. Splendig Vertrig.
Dangerously high. Alert! Alert! Read 2000 AD every week. Ask your comic book store or newsagent now. Subscribe to the galaxy's greatest comic at 2000adonline.com. Subscribe digitally on our apps for Apple, Android, and Windows 10. And download DRM free copies from 2000adonline.com. Alert! Alert! Stand by for urgent updates. Search for 2000 AD on Twitter and Facebook. Watch the latest videos at youtube.com/2000AD online and follow on Instagram at Insta2000AD. Program complete. Shutting down.